Welcome to the deep dive. Today, we're actually taking a step back. We're going to skip past, all the fancy models for a bit and really focus on the absolute basics, the foundational language of data science.
Yeah, it's crucial stuff.
Because if you really want to get good at this, truly master it, you have to understand these core ideas. What's a sample? What's a feature? And crucially, how does geometry, totally change when you get into high dimensions?
Absolutely. It's like the scaffolding, you need it. So much of modern data science really depends on understanding how data exists geometrically.
Right.
So today we're pulling together material that really defines that representation. We're talking spreadsheets, vector spaces, basic stats like mean and variance.
And the goal being to give you a real mental map of your data before you even start analyzing it.
Exactly. Build that foundation first.
Okay, so let's start with that geometry. Looking at the sources, it seems like every definition boils down to two things first. You've got a sample, which is like one thing, one customer maybe, or one email, one picture. And it's basically just a list of numbers, right? Like T dollars, T22s, all the way up to TD dollars.
Mm-hmm. And those numbers, T2 dollars to TD dollars.
Those are the features or attributes.
Precisely. So if you have, say, $1 of these samples, well, that whole collection, that's your data set.
Okay.
And straight away, that gives us our geometric picture, because each sample is just dollar numbers. You can think of it as a single point.
A point floating in space.
Exactly. A di-dimensional space toward a dollar. So the data set is just a cloud of dollar points in this dollar dimensional sample space. That's the key visual. Keep that in mind.
And it's interesting how we actually, see this in practice. The matrix, the CSV file, a data frame, even in SQL table. They're all just ways to organize that same geometric idea, aren't they? That collection of dollar points and dollar dimensions.
That's exactly it. Your typical spreadsheet view, that's usually dollar times dollar. You've got dollars for your samples and dollar columns for the features.
Right.
Classic data set layout. But then when you actually compute stuff, especially with linear algebra, you often flip it.
To an I times many.
Yeah, times any R, where each point becomes a column vector. The data itself hasn't changed, just how you're looking at it for the math.
Okay, let's make this more concrete. The sources bring up some classic examples. Starting small, the IRIS data set.
Ah, IRIS. Yeah, the hello world of classification problems. It's got $150 samples. So 150 flowers.
And each one has
24 features.
Yeah.
sepal length, sepal width, petal length, petal width. Those four numbers define each flower's point in 4D space.
And it's labeled, right? That's important.
Very important. Each of those 150 points also comes with a class label, Setosa, Versicolor, or Virginica. That's the target you're often trying to predict.
Okay, four dimensions. I can sort of picture that, maybe. But now let's jump to the other end of the scale, the one that really messes with our heads, MNEST.
Yeah, MNEST. This is where dimensions just explode and our, everyday 3D intuition completely breaks down.
It's handwritten digits, right? Yeah. Images.
Yep. 60,000 images of handwritten digits. Each image is pretty small, just 28 times 298 pixels.
Okay.
But 28 less times 280 day, that's D times 784 four features. Mm. Each pixel's grayscale value is a feature.
Wow. So every single image, every three or seven, is one point way out there in a 784 dimensional space.
Exactly. And the label is just the digit it represents, 0 through 9.
784 dimensions. I mean, how do you even begin to find patterns in something that vast? It sounds impossible.
Well, that's precisely why dimensional reduction is so critical and why it comes up so early.
Oh, okay.
Because while the data technically lives in two-way four tie, the useful information, the actual structure, it often lies on a much, much lower dimensional shape embedded inside that huge space, like a tangled sheet of paper in a giant room.
You call that a manifold, right?
That's the term, yeah. A manifold. So the goal of dimensional reduction is to find a simpler, lower dimensional space, let's call it $2, maybe with dimension way less than dollars, that still captures most of the important stuff, the variance from the original data.
So it's not that the original 784 dimensions are useless, but that the 60,000 actual data points maybe only trace out a simpler shape within that space.
You got it. Think about all the possible 28 times 2082 images you could create. Most are just random noise. The actual handwritten digits occupy a very specific structured subspace.
And the tool for finding that subspace is?
Well, the classic, the gold standard for linear dimension reduction mentioned in the sources is principal component analysis, or PCA.
PCA, heard of it.
PCA basically finds the directions in that 784 dimensional space where the data varies the most. It finds the principal axes of the data cloud.
And it can really compress things.
Amazingly well. The sources point out you can take an MNEST image, crush it down from 784 dimensions to just one single dimension using PCA.
One number.
One number. And you can still faintly recognize the original digit from that single value. It's blurry, sure, but recognizable.
Whoa. Okay, that tells you the real information content, the intrinsic dimension, is way, way smaller than 784.
Exactly. The data has a shape, a geometric fingerprint, and we're trying to figure out that shape.
That's a really powerful idea. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. From geometry to algebra, specifically the mean or average, symbol...
The good old average.
We all calculate it, but the sources make a point. Mathematically, you can't just average anything, can you? There are rules.
No, absolutely not. And this is where the concept of a vector space becomes really important. It's fundamental.
Okay.
For the mean calculation, adding things up and dividing by $9 to actually make mathematical sense, the space your data lives in has to follow specific rules. It needs to be a vector space.
Rules like?
Well, things like addition needing to be commutative.
Yeah,
A plus B has to equal B plus A.
Yeah.
You need a zero vector. And crucially, scalar multiplication has to work. If you take something in your space and multiply it by a regular number, a scalar, the result has to stay in that space.
Right. So if those rules break, the mean is meaningless or just undefined.
Pretty much, yeah. And the sources give some great counterexamples to make this clear.
It's like integers.
Yeah, think about the set of all whole numbers, integers. Pick one, say, three. Now try to scale it by a scalar like 12.
You get 1.5.
Which is not an integer. You've left the space.
Yeah.
So the set of integers isn't a vector space over the real numbers. You can't just do standard averaging if your data must remain integers.
Okay, that makes sense. And the other one you mentioned was strings.
Ah, yeah, strings are a classic example. They fail that commutative addition rule.
Because alpha plus Romeo isn't Romeo plus alpha.
Definitely not. Concatenation order matters. So if you can't swap the order when you add things, you can't properly define the kind of combinations needed for a vector mean.
Okay, but wait. This seems like a big problem. Real-world data is often categorical, right? Like the iris flower types, Setosa, Versicolor, Virginica, or coin flips, heads, tails. Those aren't points and trivals.
Exactly.
So how do we use all these powerful tools like calculating a mean on data like that?
That's where vectorization comes in. It's a crucial step, sometimes called one-hot encoding. It's basically a trick. You create a function, let's call it $5, that maps your original sample, or six axes, like heads or Setosa, to a vector. Five-Daler. Yeah. You transform the data into a space where the vector space rules do apply.
Ah, so you force it into a geometric space where the math works?
You got it. And then the mean of those new vectors becomes meaningful.
Walk me through the coin flip example again. That seemed really neat.
Sure. So you have heads and tails. Not a vector space, but let's vectorize. We can say map heads to the vector.
Okay. Two dimensions now.
And map tails to two. Now imagine you flip the coin neither old times. You get a sequence of these vectors. If you calculate the mean of all those $1 and one a vector.
You add them up component-wise and divide by $1.
Right, and what you end up with is a single vector, where it's just the proportion of times you got heads.
Whoa. Okay, so vectorizing it and taking the mean directly gives you the estimated probability.
Exactly. The algebra directly produces the core statistic. It's elegant.
That is elegant.
Yeah.
And for the iris glasses, three types.
Same idea, just three dimensions. Maybe $1 for Setosa, $2, $1 for Versicolor, and $2, $1 for Virginica.
Uh-huh.
Take the mean of those vectors across all 150 samples, and the resulting 3D vector tells you the exact proportion of each flower type in your data set.
Okay, that's a really powerful technique, turning categories into geometry. So now we know we can compute a mean new dollar for lots of data, maybe after vectorizing. Let's go back to its geometric meaning. You said it's the center, but what does it really do?
Right. So the mean isn't just any center. It has this really specific fundamental property no matter how many dimensions you're in. It's the point of best fit.
Best fit. How so?
It's the one unique point that minimizes the total squared distance to all the other points in your data set. We call that the mean squared distance, or MSD.
So if you square the distance from every data point to some candidate center point and sum those squares up, the mean dilittle is the point that makes that sum as small as possible.
Exactly. It's the point that's closest in a square distance sense to everything else collectively.
Hang on. If the mean is the best fit point, why do we sometimes hear about using the median instead?
Great question. It comes down to sensitivity. Because the mean minimizes the square of the distance, it gets pulled really hard by outliers points way far away from the others.
Right. Squaring a large distance makes it huge.
Exactly. The median, on the other hand, minimizes the sum of the absolute distances. It doesn't square them. So it's much less affected by those extreme outliers. It's more robust.
Okay. So mean is the best geometric center for clean data. Median is better if you suspect lots of weird outliers.
That's a good way to put it. For well-behaved data, the mean is the mathematically ideal center in this specific squared distance sense.
Got it. So we have the center point. Now we need to talk about spread, how scattered the data is around that center. And 1D, that's just variance, right? A single number.
Yep, simple variance.
But our data lives in another tile. How do you measure spread in like 784 directions at once?
That's where we need the variance matrix, usually called Kettler's. This is the big sibling of scalar variance.
A matrix.
Think of Q to our Clells, like a blueprint or a map. It describes the shape, the size, and even the tilt or orientation of that data cloud around the meanful.
Let's break down that blueprint. If we're just in 2D, for simplicity, Q$ is a $2 times 2-2 matrix. It's symmetric, so it looks like begin matrix, ANT, NVtrix. What are OBC dollar?
The diagonal elements, ODC dole, are the easy ones. They're just the regular variances of feature 1 and feature 2 separately. How much spread is there along the x-axis and how much along the y-axis?
Standard variance for each feature makes sense. What about ballers, the off-diagonal term?
The vol is the interesting one. That's the covariance. It measures the interaction, how feature 1 and feature 2 vary together.
So if one goes up, does the other tend to go up too or down?
Exactly. If ballers is positive, they tend to increase together. If ballers are negative, one tends to go up when the other goes down. If ballers is close to zero, there isn't much of a linear relationship between them.
And this dollar term is directly related to correlation, isn't it?
Precisely. We usually normalize it to get the correlation coefficient. The formula is Durho-Bee squared.
Okay.
This Borelli is always between Ranahan and 1. If it's close to 1 or minus 1, it means Durho-Bee is large compared to the individual variances, and the data cloud is really stretched out, almost like a line. If Cormega is dollar, the cloud might be circular or maybe tilted but not linearly related. And if Furl is exactly 1 or minus 1,
then all the data points fall perfectly on a straight line.
Perfectly on a line that passes right through the mean mark.
Wow, okay. And there's a cool connection back to the mean and the MSD, right? With the total variance.
Yes, absolutely. If you just add up the diagonal elements of Q$, so plus CT in our 2D example, or the sum of all diagonal variances in Dorel dimensions, that sum is called the total variance.
Also called the trace of the matrix, trace Q.
Right, the trace. And that number, the total variance, is exactly equal to the mean squared distance from the mean MSD as meters are.
No way. So the sum of the individual spreads along the axis equals the total average squared distance from the center.
Yep. It connects the overall spread measure, MSD, directly to the components of the variance matrix. It all ties together.
Geometrically, how do we picture this variance matrix Q$? You mentioned shape and tilt.
We often use variance ellipses. Imagine drawing contour lines around the data cloud, like on a topographical map. The variance matrix Q defines the shape and orientation of those ellipses.
So a circular cloud would have a ET dollar and butt dollars, and a long, skinny, tilted cloud would have an XC of a large dollar.
Exactly. The ellipse shows you the spread. And this visualization leads directly back to PCA again.
How so?
We can ask which direction, which unit vector captures the most variance if we project all the data points onto the line defined by $2. Mathematically, we want to maximize the quantity $2 square.
Okay. You project the data onto a line, measure the variance along that line, and find the line direction that gives the biggest variance.
That's it. And that specific vector, $2, the one that maximizes the projected variance, that's the best aligned vector.
And let me guess, that's the first principal component?
You got it. It's the direction of the longest axis of that variance ellipse. It's the direction where the data is most spread out.
So PCA is really just finding the axes of these variance ellipses defined by the mean and the variance matrix.
Fundamentally, yes. All the complex machinery of PCA boils down to understanding the geometry described by Mu and Tua.
This has been super insightful, connecting the dots between basic stats and geometry. But like we said with MNIST, our intuition is built for 2D or 3D. We need to end with that thought experiment the sources mentioned, the one that shows how weird high dimensions really are. The red ball in a cube.
Ah, yes, the hypercube paradox.
Ah.
It's a fantastic illustration of how volume and distance behave completely counterintuitively when del is its large.
Set it up for us.
Okay, imagine a cube in del our dimensions, a hypercube. Let's say its edges all have length 4.
Okay.
Now, in each corner, and there are 2D del r corners in del r dimensions, place a small blue ball, a hypersphere, with radius 1. So these balls are tucked right into the corners.
Right. In 3D, that's 8 corners, 8 blue balls.
Exactly. Now, right in the very center of this hypercube, place one red ball, another hypersphere. We want to know how big this red ball can be before it hits the blue ones.
Okay. In 2D, a square with edge 4, you've got 4 blue circles in the corners, radius 1. The red circle in the middle seems like it would be smaller.
It is. The math shows the radius of that central red ball in DLR dimensions turns out to be drawer 11.
Drawer 11. Okay, let's plug in some numbers. D2, $3.
For ED3, dollars 1, 1, which is about 0.73. So smaller than the blue balls. Radius 1, as expected.
Makes sense. What about D4, 3?
Now it gets interesting. For D4, $3, 2, $1, 2, 1, until 1.
Wait, the red ball's radius is 1?
Yep. In 4 dimensions, the central red ball is the exact same size as the 16 blue balls in the corners.
Well, already feels weird. My 3D brain didn't expect that.
It gets much weirder when you think about volume. Remember, volume in dollar dimensions scales like radius to the power of dollar.
Uh-huh.
Let's compare the volume of that single red ball to the total volume of all 2D or the blue balls. The ratio involves true dollars divided by $2. Now consider it a D dollars.
Okay. D911. The radius of the red ball is 31 quotes 31 equals 22.
So the red ball's radius is 2. The blue balls still have radius 1. What's the red ball's volume relative to a single blue ball's volume? It scales as radius D, so 29.9 dollar times bigger.
The red ball is 29.99 times the volume of one blue ball, and $29 is 512.
Right. And how many blue balls are there in 2 9s?
$2, so $209 are 12 blue balls.
So?
Wait a minute. The volume of the single red ball in the middle is $29 times a blue ball's volume. And there are 299 blue balls total. Their volumes are equal?
Exactly equal. In 9 dimensions, the volume of the one central ball is the same as the combined volume of all 512 corner balls.
That's just mind-bending. How can one ball in the middle take up the same volume as 512 balls in the corners of the same cube?
Because volume in high dimensions concentrates in weird places. It's not spread out like we think. The center becomes vast.
Our intuition is completely failing here.
And it gets even worse. What happens if D dollars is bigger than 9? See, D dollars.
That's all correct. Square root of 10 is a bit more than 3, so TOR is a bit more than 2.
TOR dollars is greater than 2. Remember, the cube's edge length was 4, so it goes from minus 2 to plus 2 along each axis. If the central ball's radius is more than 2.
It sticks out. The red ball in the center is actually poking outside the faces of the cube it's supposed to be inside?
Effectively, yes, relative to its inscribed size. This illustrates the concentration of measure phenomenon. In high dimensions, most of the volume isn't nicely contained in the middle. It's pushed out towards the boundaries, or things in the center become paradoxically large. Points tend to be far from the center and far from each other.
What a counterintuitive result. Okay, that really drives home why we can't just trust our 3D intuition when dealing with high-dimensional data like MNIST.
Not at all. The geometry is totally different.
So, wrapping up this deep dive, key takeaways. Datasets are points in tree dollars. Calculating a mean requires a vector space, which often means we need vectorization for categorical data. And variance isn't just one number, it's a whole matrix, Q of dollars, that describes the geometric shape and spread of the data.
Precisely. Understanding that geometric structure, the point cloud, the mean, the variance shape, is step one.
And you had one last provocative thought for us to chew on, something about dimension and boundaries.
Yeah, just a little something extra related to scaling and dimension.
Yeah.
Think about suspension. In geometry, if you take a dimensional shape dollar and sort of suspend it from its center point, you create a diddle plus one dimensional shape del D.
Like take a line segment 1D and suspend it from its midpoint to make a triangle to D.
Exactly. Or suspend a circle 1D boundary to make a disc 2D area. There's a cool relationship between their volumes or measures. The volume of the suspended shape hill is related to the volume of the original dollar by a factor involving the dimension. Specifically, text vol D plus $1.
Okay.
So using that principle with the circle and the disc, the area of the unit disc, which is dilatoire, should be related to the length of the unit circle, which is $2 by that rule. Area length 1 plus 1, length of 2, and sure enough, 2 del 2. Now think about how that relationship between a region's volume and its boundaries measure changes as dolly increases. How does the surface area compare to the volume change? This has huge implications for why things like density estimation become almost impossible. In very high dimensions, the curse of dimensionality strikes again, something to mull over.